Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Loomis, and welcome to another episode of the Top Deck Time. This is episode 28, I believe. That's correct. But before we actually get on to the main event of the show, let me introduce my lovely co-host from Austria. It's Rico. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I've had quite a busy weekend. I've been working over 20 hours on Friday and Saturday, so that was a little bit exhausting, but now I'm here and I'm looking forward to doing the episode.
University also started for you.
Oh yeah,
right?
so you haven't had
a lot of free time.
The week has been cramped, but I hope it gets better as soon as I get into a little bit of a routine.
And for myself, we actually haven't recorded the Top Deck Time for now 2 weeks because if you've been a frequent listener to the show, we aired our pre-recorded draft episode last week. So it really felt like it's been a long time. You know, we really always record every time on Sunday. So for me, it's been like a part of my week already.
Yeah.
And last Sunday, it kind of felt empty. And now it's been like such a long time that I recorded an episode of Top Deck Time. I'm now like, there's a lot of things stored up in me to talk about this week. But personal life-wise, I'm enjoying my last little bit of break before going to Malaysia and then flying to the United States and then Sweden and then China. So the next month is going to be jam-packed for me. We have a really jam-packed episode for you guys today covering various different topics. And without further ado, let's start with a revisit of the Carla strategy. can you quickly kind of explain to maybe viewers that might have missed
In case you missed the episode, my girlfriend discovered the 100% surefire way to get into Masters. Which is you play a deck until you lose, and at that point you build the deck you lost against, and then you keep playing until you lose again. Because naturally, if you only build the decks that you lose against, your deck is getting better every time, right?
I guess. I mean, or you're playing.
Okay, so on this talk though, the real advantage of this is you get to get a good feel of the metagame, and you get to play a lot of different decks, which helps you playing against those decks also. Like if you never played with Chalice, you might not know all the exact good ways to play against Chalice either. So this really helps you get a good grasp of how a matchup plays out and how the metagame is shaping up.
Not only that, it also kind of make you exercise those deck building muscles, I like to call them, because whenever you lose, let's say, to Skycrack aggro, there's two ways you go about it, right? You could just hit your card collection, hit new deck, and then you build a deck. Or you could just net deck it, and there's obvious advantages and disadvantages to both, but either case, you're building a new deck, or you are playing with a new deck, and you're learning a lot with that new deck as you go along.
I mean, with the Skyscrag example, like one of my favorite streamers recently did an episode where the title was like, building a Skyscrag deck, step one, put in Skyscrag cards, step two, delete deck. Is that like, accurate, or...?
That sounds about right. I approve that message, actually. I heard you talk about the Carla strategy last time, and you said how fun it was. Mm-hmm. And I recently started streaming Eternal again. And I was like, okay, I think it's a pretty good idea to do it on stream just to see how my viewers like it, how I personally liked it. And I did it, I believe, at the beginning of the month. So when, I think, day two of the new season. Ladder was very fresh. I queued up, I believe, the Rakano Caleb deck. I was like, let's go. You know, this is going to take me all the way to Master.
This is going to be good.
It didn't take me all the way to Master. So for the next, I guess, 5-6 hours where I played on stream, I essentially just switched between 5 decks. I know when you did this, you said that the meta was extremely diverse. And yes. I think you did it towards the middle and the end of the month. As you imagine, at the beginning of the month, it's more weighted towards the aggressive deck. So I played nonstop Skycrack aggro, Stone Scar aggro, or Burn Queen, Rakano, Alesia midrange, and Chalice. Those are like the 5 decks I swap back and forth. Personally, I'm not a Chalice player, so I never really understand the supposed woe of Chalice, and I'm putting everything in air quotes here. But after actually playing on the Chalice side, I'm like, hey, the deck isn't as decision free as everyone makes it to be.
Yeah.
And especially when I was building the deck at the beginning of the season, I was like, there's a lot of interesting choices you can make building a Chalice deck. You know, there's already a debate whether you should include Kothan or not. there's a debate whether you should include archive curator or not. And I think that definitely comes down to what kind of decks you are expecting to face. So for example, because I knew that, you know, it was day two of the season and I was facing a lot of aggro, I wanted Kodan in my deck because it's a 2-3 that blocks well early on. I wanted Archive Curator because it takes off things like Quick Draw or Flying that I have trouble blocking against. So I found it really nice that I could tech Chalice decks to the meta. And I think most control decks are like that in nature. But I definitely have a lot more respect for Chalice as an archetype as a whole. I still don't respect the Chalice players. But I respect the Chalice deck.
Shots fired. No, but honestly, I think like this. I think this is one of the biggest problems with the deck. Playing against Chalice is just very annoying at times, and it can be frustrating. But playing with Chalice actually is fun, at least for me. And I know. Like, people won't like that I'm saying this, but that's my opinion. I don't play Chalice a lot, but when I do, I think the games are quite interesting, actually. I got a couple of questions. You said you were only playing with about 5 different decks, but were you playing against other decks and you were just beating them, or didn't more diverse archetypes show up?
It's definitely not as diverse as you talked about it with, like, 30 different decks last time, right? Over 60 games. I didn't really log it. I did log it. I had a notepad somewhere, but I think I deleted it. But I faced maybe 15 archetypes.
Okay.
But it's just that either I'm an amazing pilot or the decks I was using was just excellent. Just running over people with Skycrag aggro. Skycrag aggro was my most successful deck. So that was nice. And I did learn something about Skycrag aggro. I know we recorded an episode with it, and you talked about a certain doggy named Alpine Tracker, right? Alpine Tracker, let's actually read it out because it's a card that we don't see too often. It's a 4-power double Skycrag influence, so 2 fire, 2 primal for a 3-3 charger. And it reads, summon Alpine Charger does 1 damage to everything, right? All your units, all their units, your and face, the their faces, face. Yeah, and has charge. So when you originally suggested Alpine Tracker, and then your deck is full of 1-drops that die to Alpine Tracker. You had like Oni Ronin, Pyro Knights, and of course the 2-1 Aegis Yeti. I'm like, this is like really dubious, right? And then when I was building the Skycrack deck, I went on EternalWarcry.com and I saw Suga A had a list on Skycrack Aggro. And I do believe Suga A is a very high level master. I definitely see him in the top 100 all the time. And supposedly he generally gets there with Skycrag aggro. So when I saw his name next to a list, I was like, okay, I'm going to just take this list and try it out. And he had 2 Alpine Tracker in the list. And I was like, okay, so this reminds me of something. It's still very dubious, but I'm going to play it out. What ends up happening, you still get like an awkward turn sometimes. So by turn 4, you have an Oni Ronin surviving. And you're going to kill your Oni Ronin when you play Alpine Tracker. But then what I found out is that if your only Ronin survives to turn 4 and you're being able to attack with it every single turn, you're probably winning already. You don't need to play Alpine Tracker. And of course, you could play around that. You could suicide your only Ronin in the previous turn to get the Warcry to make way for the Alpine Tracker. But the most important thing that I got out of the Alpine Tracker is that the Elysian mid-range decks and the Praxis mid-range decks have so many X1s, right? They play 4x Temple Scribe, they play 4x Amber Acolytes, they play 4x Dawnwalker. So what ends up happening with those boar states against those decks is just so many crap that you have to go through. An Alpine Tracker comes down, clears out the garbage essentially, and then, you know, just gets in. So it's been very impressive, surprisingly so. And I wouldn't have actually ever put Alpine Tracker in a deck if I not done this challenge. So there's already a media plus.
I think it also makes more sense to play Alpine Tracker, as you said, in the earlier days of ladder, because if you're playing against a lot of decks with like Oni Ronins or Pyro Knights, it's also like the value is also going up, right?
True.
Now, I think I also think that Skycrag is a fine choice for an aggro filled metagame, because I think Skycrag does have a pretty good edge over Burn Queen. because Permafrost is super good against them. Rock Slide is super good against them. Alpine Tracker, if you play it, can be super good against them. In general, your removal is just more efficient than theirs. And you're playing a lot of the same units. So that's just a natural advantage in the mirror.
I think their units are a little bit bigger than yours. Namely in
the Champion of Chaos and Impending Doom.
Right, so you gotta really be smart with your removal. There's a lot of times where I've seen a 2-2 Recano Outlaw on the other side, and I don't torch it, because I'm just looking at my hand. Can I beat a Champion of Chaos? Can I beat an Impending Doom? Whenever I'm up against that aggro deck, ask Skycrack, I just look at my hand and see what removal needs to be saved. So I definitely had a lot of success with the deck, and it was my most winningest deck. And I'm not sure whether that hit me all the way to Master, but I want to say it did, or very close to Masters. There you go. I am now a proponent of the Carlos strategy. Again, a disclaimer goes, you need a pretty full collection for you to actually do this. So for those of you guys that do have a full collection, we definitely do recommend it.
So Lumi, one card or archetype that I think should have been represented, but oddly wasn't in your anecdote of the challenges, the Archimport midrange and Tabrot. What happened? I haven't been able to play a lot of Eternal this week or any at all, but I have scanned the Reddit and people were talking about Tabrot a lot, but you weren't playing with or against them.
Yeah, because Tabrot wasn't out. He wasn't out yet when I did the challenge.
Oh, so it's that long ago. Okay, sorry. That makes sense. Okay.
I think Tavrat's only been out for a week and a half, 11, 12 days. I think I got Master and then Tavrat came out and I start, spewing Master points.
That's one of the problems when we don't record every week. I get confused.
Right. Yeah, as you said, we had a lot of discussion on Reddit and I guess everywhere else where the Eternal news reach. When people are talking about Tavrat, it really reminds me of people discussing the hottest anime of the season. I know you don't really follow anime that closely, but so every season, right, there's an anime that comes out and the whole entire community agrees this is the anime to watch. It might not be the best one. It's just we're gonna just agree this is the anime to watch. And by participating in this discussion, you're automatically assigned into a camp of this anime is excellent, it's gonna be the savior of anime. It's going to be the Cowboy Bebop of our times.
Best thing since sliced bread, yeah.
Exactly. Or it's a trash, overrated show.
Yeah.
We get weebs, arguing against each other.
And few opinions in between.
Right. No opinions in between. Now, I'm not saying that's actually the case for Tavrot. This whole Tavrot business just reminded me of that. But as it were, we got to put our foot down, our opinion down about Tavrot as well, right?
Sure, but I have a more important question now. If Tavrot was the main character of an anime, what would it be? What would the story be, Lumi? You're the expert on that.
Probably some sort of shonen where you train and you level up and you tackle on bigger and badder bosses. The picture of Tavrot in its art, it's probably at the end of the anime where he's all buff, He looks pretty buff in the show.
Oh, so he's the main character?
Right, you said he's the main character, right? Or if he's not the main character, he'll be the mentor of the main character,
All right.
Him pointing very fiercely, he's like, okay, go do that. Go do them 100 push-ups or whatever.
That makes sense.
I could see him that.
All right, on a little more serious note.
Right.
So, what is your opinion on the card? Again, we talked about the card already when we discussed when we made the set review, but we haven't seen him in action too much by then. So has anything changed for you?
I don't think the strength of the card has really changed for me that much, but more so my feeling on the card, which I'm not exactly sure how important it is, but given one of the most important thing that Direwolf Digital care about is how much fun their players are having with new cards coming out, I do believe it's a valid angle to look at Tavrot. So today I was at the gym, lifting and stuff.
Naturally.
Now my knees are weak and my arms are heavy. I was actually thinking, because when we kind of talked about Tavrot, we also rated Tavrot, right?
Yeah.
I believe you gave Tavarot a 4 out of 5. Was that correct?
That's correct, but that's like you have to consider the rating scale. Like the like 4 for me was a card that is extremely good in one archetype but doesn't fit into every deck playing those factions, if that makes sense. Like for example Chalice or Sinan Obelisk. Those are really good but only in specific decks, and 5 are cards like Oni Ronin, Torch, Sandstorm Titan. Like they are good in every deck that play, or it, no wait, actually Oni Ronin is a 4/2, but Sandstorm Titan and Torch, for example, are just excellent in every time or fire deck. So those
correct.
Those get a 5 rating.
So based on your scale rating, I gave it a 4.5
mm-hmm.
because I feel like Tavarot isn't really just in an Argentport archetype. Like he goes into, we've seen people do very well with Argentport with Tavarot, but they also play it in Armory, of course.
Yep.
I've seen Goblin Queen play it in more of a Argentport splashing time,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then kind of just be a very threat dense deck with Desert Marshal and Mystic Ascendant in the top end. So I feel like Tavarot goes into more decks and he's a powerful engine in all of them. So that's why I rated it a little bit higher than you. But then, so back to the gym story, I was like, okay, so Tavarot is all the rage, but he's still not the best card in the game, right? Because I think both of us rate Sandstorm Titan as 5, right? As a unit. And I was just thinking, can I directly compare Sandstorm Titan to Tavarot? Obviously, two are very different units. They die to different sort of removal. There are a lot of, they go into separately different decks. So I'm just asking myself, as more of a player looking into these two units, which one would I rather see my opponent play on the other side of board? Which one will give me less fun when my opponent play it? And I quickly came to the conclusion that despite Sandstorm Titan being a quote-unquote more powerful card, both of us rating it higher, I would much rather see Sandstorm Titan on the other side. Simply for the reason that if Sandstorm Titan hits me 3 times, ouch, it hurts. But I could deal with a Sandstorm Titan eventually and do okay. If Tavarot hits me 3 times, it hits for 5 damage the same, but I think the game's already over.
I absolutely agree with that, but I do think it's a very unfair comparison because there are way more decks that are playing Sandstorm Titan, more different decks, so that's one of the reasons that Sandstorm Titan, in my opinion, is just a better card because it fits into more decks. And also it comes down a turn earlier, which when you're playing an aggressive deck really does make a huge difference. So obviously when they are played, like it's you can't really compare a five cost multi-faction card with a 4 cost mono-faction card. Like that's, I'm more scared of, for example, like it's the card called Crown Watch Deserter, the 3 power, 1 fire, 1 justice, 3/3 war cry, or an Oni Ronin. Well, I'm more scared of the 3/3 war cry, obviously, because it's just stronger. But Oni Ronin is still the better card, right?
So maybe I kind of muddle up my point by bringing up the comparison to Sandstorm Titan. But I think my major point is that I have a lot less fun when Tavarot is on the board, because the game quickly devolves into a situation of, can I kill Tavarot now?
It is very problematic if your opponent, like if your opponent plays this and you don't have an answer, you're not quite dead yet, but you know that the game will be super hard, if not impossible to win, if you don't like draw an answer to him soon. And that's not a great feeling, and I get that.
Oh, you know what the worst part of this? If I could kind of, I don't know, drive the point a little bit further. It's like when you're playing Monopoly, right? And let's say it's 1v1 Monopoly, me versus you, right?
Alright.
And you own like 3/4 of the whole board, right? That's Tavarot. And then, so like, technically I haven't lost yet. Technically I'm still in the game, right?
Yeah.
Technically Tavarot could miss. So every turn when you attack, I'm like, okay, I'm going to take 5 and hope you miss. It's like, I know I'm in a losing situation, but I have to sit there and find out how am I going to lose. So that's like, ugh, that just feels bad.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we all also touched on this when we first talked about the card. Like, him needing like immediate attention is a problem. And it's really kind of a feel-bad moment when they draw and play a Tavrodon curve and you just don't happen to have drawn your answer. And I agree with that. That being said, I actually think that people are still overreacting a little bit. Like, I'm not saying that Tavrod isn't very good, and I'm not saying that it is super fun to play against him all the time. But I think he's not quite the end-all, be-all card that, like, is unbeatable, or I don't know, that just absolutely needs to be turned down, like, tuned down. I don't know. People have been complaining about Sandstorm Titan since the game is out, basically, and that's like more than a year now, and he hasn't been nerfed, and he's still okay. Tavrod is a different card because of that feel bad moment, but I do still think that the card is okay, and it's a card that Argentport kind of like. A lot of people have been asking for, or have been complaining that Argentport can't generate card advantage and can't draw cards. And I think this is a very, well, a good way to implement card advantage to Argentport, because it's not, you can't do a Wisdom of the Elders, like you can't do a 3-power draw two cards, or you can't do, I don't know, something, some spell that only draws cards. You can't really do that in Argentport, I think, because it doesn't fit the identity. And Tavrod generates card advantage in a different way. Obviously, when he attacks, he draws cards, but also if he doesn't get to attack, he sometimes will generate card advantage by just being hard to remove. Like, sometimes you will need two cards to get rid of him, or sometimes you need to double block him, and that's a way for Argentport to, like, be able to play a little bit of a longer game. So I think a card like Tavrod is a good way to implement card advantage into Argentport. It just happened to be on a card that is also very, very good and one of the best we've seen in a while, which might be frustrating to some players. I think that we should trust Direwolf on this. For example, do you remember when we talked about the armory nerfs and talked about how we think they overdid right. a little bit?
Now it all makes sense.
It makes sense now. Like, they got a new toy, and I don't know. It seems to me that Direwolf, they know what they are doing. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with all the Reddit posts. Is like, Direwolf, they have no idea what they are doing. What have they done? What were they thinking? This is horrible game design. I don't know. I tend to trust them, and I haven't been disappointed, to be honest. So I tend to err on that side. We don't know what set 3 will bring. They do. We don't know what set 4 will bring. They do. We don't know if there will be promos or campaigns. They do. So maybe we just have like a few weeks or months of a metagame where Argentport is a stronger choice. And I don't think by any means that Argentport is the best choice around, or the best deck by far. I think it's obviously tier 1, but it's not in any way, shape or form oppressive, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I think we can just accept that Argentport is a major play in the metagame, and try to adapt and wait what will change in the future.
I agree with essentially everything you've said. The point I made about Tavrod being unfun, that's just more of a personal feeling about the card. If I was a different person or someone with different personality, I might just be on the side of Tavrod and be like, oh yeah, he's fine. And I do think he's actually okay. You're not going to see me going on Reddit or emailing DWDs like, we need a nerf on this card. Because the card in itself, you know, we already talked about the very restrictive casting cost, which double Argentport requirements. Also, I feel like he has a relatively restrictive deck building cost.
Yes.
Which is kind of an awkward thing to talk about. But there is Auric Runehammer, which is a great one to hit. And then after that, there is no ubiquitous, what is the next one? Maybe Auric Interrogator, the 4-3 that pings yourself to draw a card. Like, that's sort of good. I've seen people including Talon of Nostrix. You know, if you're playing Minotaur, you're playing those cards that are not really at the level of Tavrod. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like Tavrod is very strong, but he's also limited, currently at least, by the cards that are existing in the card game. So I think maybe in the future, if we revisit like Tavrod, maybe like, let's say, a year from now, where there's a lot more relic weapons or weapons being printed and more Minotaurs around, maybe we need to revisit whether being able to look at a top five card and drawing a Minotaur and weapon is perhaps too strong, but I think right now he's on the edge of being too powerful, but I think does not need a nerf at the moment yet.
Oh, that's one thing that I forgot to mention, though. Like, he obviously hits normal weapons as well, as we all
correct,
know. But
yeah.
Like, one of the problems, quote-unquote, with the card, well, you mentioned it is unfun to play against him, and I tend to agree. Like, it can be a very sinking feeling for you if your opponent plays this and you can't answer it. But what also amplifies this is that it's mostly played in a deck that is also playing Batholo and Lethrai Falchion.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
That can be frustrating to lose against also. So, like, the whole Archonport deck as a whole, it can be frustrating to play against, honestly, if you don't draw your answers in time, or if you can't put up a fight.
Batholo in particular.
So yeah, Batholo is very annoying to deal with and can be frustrating to play against, but also just the Lethrai Falchion can be super frustrating to play against. Like, if you're an aggressive deck and you're ahead and you think, okay, now I almost got this in the back, and they slam a Falchion on an impending doom and hit you for 9, like, it's not feeling good for you, right? So there's a lot of cards in bundled together in one deck that just create sort of a feel bad moment, and like, those you will remember those times way more than the times where they didn't, like, their draw didn't line up, or they had Batholos and no weapons, or they didn't hit with Tevrek.
Right.
You like those you don't tend to keep in mind, but you remember those where they top decked that Falchion, or you remember those where they curved Batholo into Falchion, or you remember those where they had the Tevrek on 5 and you didn't draw the removal. And those can be frustrating games to lose. The other thing, I think Tevrek is pretty cool to play with. It's always a double-edged sword. You like when you're creating cards, they need to be fun to play with, but not super unfun to play against. Tevrek is a little on the side of being unfun, but I trust Direwolf. I think they know what they are doing, and yeah, that's my input on that discussion, I think.
I hope that we had a gentlemanly discussion. I know we're both wearing our top hats and monocle right now, trying
sure.
to make sure the salt does not seep through too much.
Yeah, combing my mustache. Yeah.
Oh man, I'm a poor Asian man that can't grow a curly mustache. So no mustache for me. But I think this is a good transition to go from Tavrod to talk about the ETS result. Whether Tavrod is all of that.
Well, the tournament got taken down by Darkness 3827 with Cheeto Queen. Queen has always been a very, very strong contender for ETS.
Always a player.
Decks, so that's not too much of a surprise there. The inclusion of Cheeto is a little bit interesting, I think. Decks have been erring on the no Cheeto side for a while now, but this one is more aggressive without Champion of Chaos. This is one feedback that we got, that we don't go over the cards at all, and we haven't again for the entire podcast. So if you're a new player,
no, that's not true.
You're
I
thinking,
went.
What are they talking about? Yeah, you explained the one card. That's true. Okay, so Frontier Cheeto is a 2-power 1/1 that gives all your one cost units charge, a one or less.
Right.
This card used to be a 1-power card itself, and back then it saw a lot of play. And when they changed the cost to 2. It kind of faded out of the metagame, but Queen versions that play Cheeto, basically they are even more aggressive than the usual Burn Queen or bigger Burn Queen decks you might have seen. So this deck uses a lot of cheap units, like it plays Grenadine Drone, the Knife Check, Oni Ronin Pyronet, so a lot of one drops, and as well as Assembly Line and Rally, so it's really all in aggressive. It's also playing Lurkin's Angwar. So it's really super all-in. And yeah, like when you look at the rest of the top 8, we have 4 Archonport mid-range decks, obviously all starring the Batholo, Lethrai Falchion, Tevrek beauty that we talked about. And then we have a Sinan Killers, Elysian Dinosaurs, which is kind of interesting, and a big Combre deck. Like, when you're trying to beat Tevrek, you can try a couple of different things, and Darkness decided that going under him and going as aggressive as possible is one of the better ways to beat him. If he's dead by turn four, he ain't going to play the five power unit, right? Right? So that's one way to do it, and it definitely paid off. Also, if you are just looking for a deck to farm Gauntlet with, this looks like it could do so pretty quickly. Or yeah. If you just want your quick win of the day, this looks like the deck you can play. Like, I don't think that the games will take more than 2 or maybe 3 minutes, because either they are dead or you can't win anymore. So that might be interesting for a couple of you guys. I recommend you checking that deck out.
The funniest thing, actually, on EternalWarCry.com, where we're looking at this deck list, under the information section, it says, innovating is for blockers. Smork, smork, smork. I love that the most.
Great. That's great.
I guess it's like a funny note, but this is actually like, I think the innovation is actually, in this case, on the attacker, because you brought up a good point, right?
Mm.
I think the only relevant cards in your opponent deck, if you're playing against the Argentport midrange deck, is how many Bloodletters do they have, or how many Bloodlet Falchions do they have? Because as good as Tavrod is, they are dead by the time they cast Tavrod. This deck, you could, like, on turn two, you could crash in with multiple attackers, and then you could play Lurking Sanguires.
Yeah.
And if you look at the removal that most Argentport decks are playing, they're playing, like, Slay and Vanquish. Yeah, Vanquish, sure. Good against Lurking Sanguire. Dead card against pretty much any other card in your deck. Slay? Embarrassing against your...
Embarrassing against your one drops, yeah. Yes.
So it's just really attacking from the metagame from a really, really nice position. So I'm glad that went all the way. Apparently the final score was 3-0, so...
That's pretty impressive. So let's talk about the big Combry next, because I think that's the other option you have.
Okay.
Going over Tavrod. And we talked about how the Power Stone might be nice for a big Combry deck, and...
We see three here.
We see three here. It was played by Flash 2351. There's nothing really special in here, I think. It's your quote-unquote stock big Combry list, I think. So there's not a lot of surprises. He chose to play 8 Silence, which not all the big Combry decks do, but most of them
Yeah, can
do.
I talk about that real fast? Yeah, because yeah. I think the Silences doubles as a way to deal with Tavrod, right? Tavrod, sure. A lot of the power of the card is the fact that it has endurance and the text box of the card. And once you remove it, it's just going to bounce off a Sandstorm Titan.
Yep.
And it makes it a super manageable card. And now you're looking at... So you have 4 Desert Marshal, you have 4 Valkyrie Enforcer, you have 4 Vanquish. That is 12 ways to deal with Tavrod, and you have a lot of turns to draw into those. And also, one of the strengths of the Argentport deck is that it really taxes your removal in between Bartolo and Tavrod, because Bartolo already demands 2 cards to deal with it, and same with Tavrod, you mentioned earlier, sometimes demands 2 cards to deal with it, and having all of these extra ways to go through both Bartolo and Tavrod, I think it's also another very good way to tackle Argentport.
Yeah, I agree. And then they try to go over the top with like a couple of the full playset actually of the Great Parliament and Mystic Ascendant to ensure just a better late game. One thing that is interesting is like it's always a debate whether Big Combry wants to run Harsh Rule or not, and Flash decided he didn't want them, at least in the main deck. He's running a playset, the full playset of Vanquish though in the main deck, so he came prepared to mess with the bull.
Yeah. I think this is, again, a very smart way to tackle it. And also, I do want to point out the sideboard a little bit. It's also pretty common nowadays that big Combry decks are now siding into Vodacon as a alternate win condition alongside Voiceless Speaker. And the reason you want to do that is against some of the other control decks out there, you just want to go bigger and more powerful. I think this is a very standard sideboard plan against, let's say, Chalice decks, which there are no Chalice decks in the top 8. Can we talk about the Dino deck? Because
yes. All right.
The Dino deck looks like really interesting. There are some like really weird numbers in there. So when I say Dino deck, or when Jez2718 submitted Dino deck, it really doesn't actually have a lot of dinosaurs. It has 4 Evelina, has 1 Avrass Familiar, 3 Terrax Hatchling, the 2/1 Echo Flyers. 4. And it has two Aviasaur Patriarch, the 4-power 2/4 that reduces the cost of your dinosaur by 1. And it has the ultimate to pump up your dinosaur by +2/+2 permanently. And of course, it has 3 predatory Carnosaur at the top and 2 hunting Teriax, the 5/3/5 ambush flyer, also a dinosaur. All things said, this isn't a, hey, I'm going to just put in all cards that either say Explorer for Evelina or Dinosaur to benefit off of Evelina. This is more of like a less all-in approach. It's still playing things like Initiate the Sands or Dawnwalkers or Cirso, Champion of Wisdom, Xenon Obelisk, Crystallize, things like that. So it's kind of do halfway Elysian midrange and halfway Dinosaurs. And just on paper, neither of us has really played with the decks, but do you think this is a good approach, or do you think this is...
I actually, like, looking at this, and the more I think of it, I think this is pretty smart to play this when you want to play Elysian and you expect Tevrod. This deck is, like, the Elysian deck teched against Tevrod, in my opinion. So one thing that is important to note is the omission of Sandstorm Titan. He's not playing any. And that is because he's playing a couple of, quite a lot of flying units in the Teriax Hatchling, the Aviasaur Patriarch. He's also playing Champion of Wisdom instead of the Titans. And he's running, as you already mentioned, the Hunting Teriax. So he's running a lot of flying units that can go over Tevrod and just finish the game, which he couldn't if he played Titan. So that's one edge he has over a quote-unquote normal Elysian deck. In addition to that, he's playing 4 Xenon Initiation with 4 Cirso, which are a great answer to pretty much everything that the Archimport deck can do to you. And Killer is very efficient at dealing with Batholia in particular because it ignores the Aegis. Also, the Predatory Carnosaurus, he's playing 3 of them. He has Xenon Initiation, Evelina, and Xenon Obelisk to get them to be a 7/7, which just then eats Tevrod. In my opinion, this is just an Elysian deck tech against Archimport, and I think it did a pretty good job at that. I am kind of curious about the numbers on Aviasaur Patriarch. He is playing only 2. Champion of Wisdom, he's playing 3. And the Everex Familiar, the one-off, that seems a little bit odd to me.
Right, the numbers seem so a bit odd.
I'm a little bit curious about that, but I think if you enjoy playing Elysian and you are having trouble against the Archimport decks, this is a pretty smart adaptation.
Yeah. I definitely actually want to take this for a spin into the ladder and see how it goes. Maybe change the numbers here and there. I definitely want to play closer to 4 Aviasaur Patriarch, because there are some very sickening turns that you could do with discounting your dinosaurs and, of course, ultimating a little bit later once you have the extra power to go with it.
Yeah, but I like the Patriarch a little bit more when you're also running Twin Brood Sauropod, but Twin Brood matches up pretty poorly against pretty much every deck right now. You don't want Twin Brood Sauropods against the hyper-aggressive decks. You don't really want it against Archimport. It's pretty expensive.
Do you even
want
Twin Brood? Because I feel like...
I don't think so. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, and that's why I'm not sure how many Aviasaur Patriarch you want.
I'm saying in a normal dinosaur deck, I'm not even sure if you want Aviasaur or Twin Brood, because one of the strengths of Aviasaur is going from 4 to 6, right? And essentially, you could go Aviasaur into Carnosaur. Fair enough. That's kind of Christmas land territory, because, you know, it's pretty hard to cast these cards, but that is the possible draw.
The other thing that I was if somebody like told me to build a dino deck, I would at least be tempted to play around with Watch of the Big Ones a little bit, just because he's a dinosaur explorer. But yeah, it makes sense that the stat line just doesn't really match up in the current metagame, I think. So yeah, all in all, I really like this adaptation of Jess. I think this is a good job, and I think that there's more to the deck than you see at first glance. And yeah, I enjoyed that.
Looking at the ETS results overall again, it seems like it's either Argenport midrange with Bart and Tevrod, or decks that are aimed to beat it.
I wouldn't say they are necessarily aimed to beat it, but I think they...
Or teched against it.
I mean, I think this... like you're playing Elysian, you're not playing Elysian to beat Tevrod decks. You're playing Elysian because it's good in other matchups. But you can build your Elysian deck in a way that it's also not like that all that it doesn't get beaten by Archimborg all the time. This is another thing that we maybe forgot to mention when we talked about Tabard. He hasn't been out that long, so people like maybe have not found all the good ways to build their decks to beat him. And I think this is this is a step in the right direction.
Right. So I think it goes back to something that you said earlier, where we just need to recognize that Argentport is one of the tier one decks now.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to play against it, you need to have an idea or a strategy in mind. What do I do when you face up against Argentport midrange? Because you will.
Yep.
And I think all of these decks have alternate game plans, if you will, against Havrat decks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the Seeming Killers deck by Bradykin.
Sure.
If you don't mind. So he, like, Seeming Killers is this time shadow. I mean, most of you will know, playing just big dumb units and trying to win on stats mostly. I really love the Aurig Interrogator in the list, and Aurig Interrogator is actually a card that has shown up in the top 8 decks quite a lot, because it's in every single Archimport deck, and it's basically in every shadow deck except for the Queen deck that's in the top 8. So I think that's pretty impressive for the card. The Aurig Interrogator, of course, the 3 power double shadow 4/3, and if he has 5 or more attack at the end of your turn, you are dealt 1 damage and draw a card. And the way he's enabling it is Scene Initiation, that +1/+1 and killer on one of your units, and Scene on Obelisk, as well as Dark Return. So he actually has a lot of ways to turn him on. And if you are in a value-based game, like having one Aurig Interrogator, like just surviving for 1 or 2 turns, does put you ahead, but quite substantially, I think. Again, the deck does have the option to get rid of the Tevrat by just having blockers, which is one of the easier ways to do so, I think. It just has a lot of like big units, so he can double block. But also he has the Predatory Carnosaur with Obelisk again, or with Scene Initiation once he killed once already. He also is running a couple of Death Strikes. Bradykin is basically the... Like, Bradykin with the Sinan Killers as well as the Dinosaur decks, they are playing midrange and trying to beat the midrange that is Archimport by just having more beef and answers. Whereas the other decks, like, one of them was trying to go over and one of them was trying to go under. So I think it's nice to see that there's an option for, like, every... or there are a couple of options you can still play and they're still viable. Like, going under, going on equal footing, but having answers in mind and going over Tabra. That's another reason why I don't necessarily think that he will be absurdly problematic in the future.
I want to point out that the one common thing between the two time deck that are essentially trying to out midrange the Tabra decks is that they have 4 copies of Xenon Initiations. Combined with, let's say, Xenon Obelisk or your Carnosaur, just able to take them over the critical threshold dealing 7 is very important, but also having a quick and easy way to deal with Bartholo on the earlier turns.
Yeah.
That's also super important. So I think Xenon Initiation, it might seem like just a big brother of Predatory Instinct, but this is more like the great grandfather of Predatory Instinct. When it comes to like how much more powerful it is, just giving that actual +1/+1. And of course, you brought up how it works very nicely with Aurig Interrogator.
Mm-hmm.
So frequently when I play this deck, turn 5, I go Aurig Interrogator, Xenon Initiation, kill one of your dude, press enter, draw a card. It's just like so much
it
value.
It feels so good, yes.
That's when I'm playing Monopoly and, you know, I just bought that very last building, the Boardwalk, I think it was called.
Oh, yeah.
It's nice.
Feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I the first time I saw this was on Sarina's stream. He's always trying out new stuff and I like his attitude. He's saying like, yeah, sure, I could like try and tune Chalice to the meta, but to the metagame, but like other people are doing that. I just try to explore things that other people might not have done already. And sometimes he loses a lot, but sometimes he doesn't. And I still think it's like he's contributing a lot to deck builders in general, because he's trying stuff so you don't have to, which is always nice. I just wanted to give him a quick shout out because it reminded me of the deck. One thing I was really, really missing in on ladder as well as in the ETS is what happened to my bra?
Who's your bra?
What happened to my Crimson Fire Maw?
Oh, yeah. Where is that guy? You know, I remember the thing that you mentioned that we were comparing him to the impending doom.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot whether it was you or me that brought it up. It has 4 health. Yeah. Guess what? All these Justice decks are running Ward Greenhammer. 4x.
Yeah, that's a problem for the card, certainly.
So I feel like Crimson Fire Maw has all the power he needs. He's more like that kid that show up at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, that sounds very accurate.
Yeah, give him like 2 months, you know? Yeah. Give him 2 months where the hammer goes away, then he gets to...
He brought a knife to a gunfight.
Right. When you brought up Sir Rhino, I thought that was the perfect transition, because he's trying decks so you don't have to our next topic of the day.
Ooh, yes, yes, yes.
Which is the deck that I tried, so you don't have to. And we aptly named it Wood Tier Destroyer.
Yeah.
Was there any reason that we named it this?
There was, but I'm not sure we want to mention this on this podcast.
Right. So I don't know if you guys remember an old episode. I forget which episode it was. We must talked about an infinite combo that we did previously,
the
right?
God control.
The God control combo?
I'm sure we must have.
New cards came out. In fact, the cards have all been here for a long time to revamp the infinite damage combo.
Mm.
But we got different pieces now. So here is the new infinite combo. Involves Westwind Herald, Cabal Spymaster, and Bad News. And I definitely think we should read all those cards. they're not being played. So let me start with the most important piece, which is Westwind Herald. This is a 5-power 2/2 flyer with Aegis, and it costs double primal, and it reads Infiltrate, play a spell from your void. So I think Westwind Hero, out of all of our combo pieces, has probably the closest constructive viability, because that line of text, you play a spell from your void, essentially, well, for free, once you connect with Westwind Hero. This is an insanely powerful effect. You see other decks trying to, let's say, discard Channel of the Tempest, or even Aid of the Huru, and then connect in to cheat out, essentially,
mm-hmm.
7 or 8 power worth of free spells. It's just an amazing payoff card. In our deck, it's doing something similar, but it also acts as our win condition. Now, the card that Westwind Hero will want to bring bad is a card called Bad News. Bad News is a very bad legendary spell that I crafted 3.
Whoa. Head respect.
All right, okay. Maybe not. Okay, it's a fine spell. It costs 6 power, and it's double fire requirement, and it has warp. It reads, ready units, they can attack again. So you can see where we're going with this, right? We attack with Westwind Herald, we play warp, so that means our Westwind Hero is refreshed, essentially, and can attack again. But you may ask, wait, even if you attack again, you already trigger infiltrate once, so how can you get your bad news back again? Then that comes with our final piece called Cabal Spymaster. It's a 4-power 4/4 with 1 Felm requirement, so 1 Primal and 1 Shadow. And the text on that 4/4 reads, your units can infiltrate any number of times. So once you have these pieces all together, you are attacking in 2 a turn, recasting bad news, attack for 2, bad news, attack for 2, bad news, attack for 2, bad news. It is a slow and painful experience. All my opponent has conceded before I actually kill them with it, but when it actually does go off, it is hilarious. It is actually hilarious.
It is. Now, Lumi, that sounds great, but isn't all of that very expensive?
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to revisit this deck or have the courage to build this deck again is because we had a new card called Kindle, which is also a card we need to read because we know nobody's playing it. 3-power spell, 1 fire requirement. It says plus 4 power this turn, and then spark plus 5 power this turn. I don't even think it's that great of a card in this deck, but it just helps you to get really cheesy acceleration wins, where you attack in with Westwind Herald. Sometimes you grab Kindle off of from your void to get extra power that turn to do more stuff. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you go Kindle into plain bad news. So it just helps you to smooth out your draws. Like you mentioned, there's so, like, your combo pieces is a 4, 5, and 6, right? These are some you're super expensive
power. Yeah.
So Kindle gives you some of that power in the crucial turns of the game.
It does. And also, like, Quarry does reduce the cost, which is also pretty good. And also, we play in my boy.
Your boy.
So the Crimson Fire mod. And we added a couple of second sites as well, because that way you can control what you make cheaper if you control the fire mod. You can also always, if you have enough power, you can put back a bad news and warp it. So that's pretty cool.
Which we've done before. It's also running 4 of Swindles and 4 of Wisdoms. Mm-hmm. With this deck, you're basically taking a bunch of damage, saying, okay, I hope I don't die, let me draw as many cards as possible. And the whole, you know, attack game with the dude Kindle into Swindle is, like, pretty decent. That's when I'm not too sad about playing Kindle just to accelerate me a little bit further, because if you draw 3 cards to make up for Kindle, that's not too bad. The card that actually impressed me the most is the Haunting Screams that we have in the list. Because infinite damage is always nice, right? Let's not
gonna kid ourselves with that.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. But what tends to happen is that you won't do infinite damage. You could bad news, like, once, and that's, like, not enough. Let's say you have Westwind Hero and you attack and you can get back bad news. That's it. You don't have Spy Master on the field. What we've done a couple of times is that we Haunting Scream back Crimson Fire Mauls. And of course, like, we play Crimson Fire Maul, it'll die, right? Because, you know, everyone's slamming into it with Auric Runehammer. But I've got people a couple of times where I go Haunting Scream, attack in for 7 with Westwind Herald and Crimson Fire Maul, bad news, attack you for 7. And that's just the burst damage that people don't expect. And I double discount the next 2 draws, and then you're kind of just going off. Even though I built this deck and we're both very biased for it, let's not kid ourselves, the deck is terrible.
It's
like it doesn't combo off very frequently. It might call itself the Wood Tier Destroyer, but this is really a Wood Tier deck. It's just not gonna win you a lot of games.
To be fair, sometimes you win with it against the Gauntlet, and that's always fun.
Sometimes.
So yeah, obviously your game plan is to have a 4/4 and a 2/2 in play at the same time without your opponent being able to remove either one in the world of Slays and Runehammers and like Killers and what have you. And then you need to connect with a 2/2 flying unit where people,
which is hard, it's really hard.
People can interact with a 2/2 flying unit most of the time, and then you need to be not dead at the time. I mean, playing this against any sort of aggressive deck just feels so bad. Because
I mean, I have 4 Grenadine drones in here, right? Our Grenadine drones.
You can try to jump a little, but, like, if you're playing against a Burn Queen deck and your plan is to play a 2/2 on turn 5, you're not going to have a good time. If you're playing this deck and you're trying to attack against a time deck with Sandstorm Titan, it's going to be hard. If you're playing against somebody with Auric Runehammer, you're going to run into problems. I'm not saying you can't beat those decks. I'm saying this deck probably isn't tier 1 yet. But, yes. But it sure is a hell of fun to play. And it's actually pretty hard to play also.
It's very difficult to play. Rico would watch me. He's my trusty co-pilot. And every turn I do something, and he goes like, wait, but could we have done this, and this instead? Because with this deck, your power is so tight. You know, every turn, you're either developing a combo piece, let's say Cabal Spy Master or Crimson Fire Maul, or you're saying, okay, should I do that, or should I draw into and making sure I have all the combo piece, like playing Swindle or Wisdom. And all of that is done while you're getting beat in the face, like, 5 or 6 a turn. So it's just like, time is limited. You have to make all the right plays. It's so hard to win with this deck, but it is so, so satisfying when you
do. Yeah, so satisfying. But yeah, like, in a deck with that much card draw, you obviously have so many options, and knowing when to discount what and when to, like, kindle out something, and it's really interesting to play and fun to play. So if you if you like want to play a very suboptimal deck against Gauntlet, which will take you a long time to finish the game and then probably not win you the 7, by all means go for it. It's really worth it, I think.
You could tick it into casual mode.
Oh yeah,
I feel this is definitely a casual mode deck. Mm-hmm. Right,
for sure,
in both the quality and also the way that it wins.
That being said, I think it's the best infinite combo deck we have at the moment, because the other I think so, because the other options that I have in mind are either assembling all 4 Wind Heralds and a mirror image.
Right.
So what that does is, if you have like, there are 4 different Wind Heralds, and if you have all of them in play at the same time, which will never happen because they are 1/3 a 2/2 and 2/3/2s that die to basically everything, but if you do, they transform into this Avatar of Wind, I think it's called, and it's a 16 power 9/9 flying that when you play it, it deals 5 to every flying unit and to your opponent's face, and every time it hits your opponent, you're allowed to play a spell from the void. So if you have a mirror image, you can copy it, deal 5 again, copy it, and so on. So that's an infinite combo, but that involves 5 cards, and those are even weaker than the ones we are playing. And the other option is also with the Herald Spymaster, but combo finish, quote unquote, is again with Kaldarin Gunsmith, which is the 5-power 3/2 that on summon has all of your units deal 1 damage to your opponent. So that triggers infiltrate, and again with mirror image to play from your void, because your Northwind Herald, it triggers, you get to play the mirror image again, copy Kaldarin Gunsmith, it triggers again, and so on and so forth. So those are the options that I have in mind. And the latter two, you have to jump through even more hoops to get there. So, yeah.
What you said makes sense, right? Like, for the Kaldarin Gunsmith, it's a 4-card combo compared to it, only a 3-card one. But what the Gunsmith allows you to do is not interact with the attacking step of the game.
That is fair.
You never need to attack. So,
yeah.
You know, the problem of like, oh, they have Sandstorm Titan, how is my 2/2 going to go in? You don't have to worry about it with this. So,
there's
some plus and minuses. As per usual, the deck list of, what do we call it, Wood Tier Destroyer will be on topdecktime.wordpress.com. I know it's very against the title of the show called Top Deck Time. This is definitely not a top deck.
This is a bottom deck.
But, you know, we gotta balance out the Argent Port midrange with a little bit of meme in there, right? You know,
yeah.
We are trying decks, so you don't have to.
Yeah, and should you want to check out top decks this week, I recommend you going to eternalwarcry.com. You can see all the ETS decks, the top 8 that we talked about there. Just go to tournament decks, and the latest ETS is where you find all the decks we talked about. And you can find a ton of different decks there as well. So definitely check that out.
There was an event this week. You just play in it. There is no special rules. The rewards are pretty standard, I believe, as events go. It's 3,000 gold to enter, or I believe 300 gems.
Yes, that's correct.
And you get, even if you win 0 games, you get the 3-pack back. So essentially, it's like paying 3,000 gold to buy 3 packs. You get premium cards as soon as you pick up any wins. And you get, you know, chests the higher you go.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't play in at all. Did you?
I haven't had the time.
If you're ever on the leaderboard, you get packs.
Yeah, just participating. Like, if you're playing one event, you, like, even if you win 0 times, you will get 4 packs. So actually, it's a discount already on buying packs, because everybody that participates in the event at least once gets at least 1 pack from the leaderboard prices. So there are run prices and leaderboard prices. Yeah. And the leaderboard prices, basically everybody that's not in the top 5,000 will get a pack. And if you're between place 1,000 and 5,000, you get 2. So that's where most people will end up being. Like, so you still get something even if you do end up having an unfortunate run. And as soon as you hit 4 wins, you get get 4 packs from the run prices already. So that's a very good deal then. But yeah, Lumi, talk to me about the price structure.
I was streaming all throughout the week, and as the event got announced, new players are asking me, should you put down the 3,000 gold to play in the event. This is actually something that we didn't touch on in our new player episode. Mm. But the answer to that is most likely not, because as a new player, your deck is probably not finely tuned, so you might not be able to do as well as all the other players. You're better off spending that gold to further improve your collection by going to draft or whatnot. However, if you do need like to open mass booster packs, this might be a decent way to give a shot in the arm, as it were, to your booster collection, if that makes sense. But I think drafting is still perhaps the best way to go if you're looking to improve collection. And then for more of the players that have a little bit of gold lying around, they don't need a draft for collection anymore, and they don't really need to buy packs either because the collection is pretty much well-rounded. Then it comes down to whether the event is fun. And in this particular event, it's just normal rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just coming down to the question of, like, what is the incentive of playing in the event? I mean, obviously fun is a part of it, and you do earn a couple of packs. But personally for me, that's not enough to convince me to play in this event. What about you? Like, let's say if you had the time, would you might consider playing this event like 3 times to get yourself into the leaderboard?
Yeah, I think I would play 3 runs if I had the time, like given the time. Yeah, for the packs, but also like this event has a couple of advantages. I think for new players and for veteran players as well. When you're playing ladder, time is absolutely a factor, and how fast you can close out games is absolutely a factor, because if you want to climb or if you just want to grind gold, you want to finish games quickly, and that's why on ladder there's a bias towards aggressive decks. And in this deck, the time in which you finish the game doesn't matter at all. So decks with a higher win rate get more interesting.
Great point.
For example, I think that playing Chalice on ladder can be very tedious because the games just take forever to win or lose. And you're not doing any climbing, you're not doing any grinding. But I think Chalice is a deck with a pretty good win rate against the field in general, so playing it in this event should be fun actually, and the time actually doesn't really matter to you. For the new players, I've seen a couple of posts made by new players on Reddit that were like, so is drafting really the best option, because I'm not really into that, I don't really enjoy drafting, or I suck at drafting, and I just want to get cards, but I like buying booster packs seems inefficient. And this is actually a pretty cool way to do it, because you get to play your constructor deck and you get a super good deal on booster packs. Basically, you can buy 4 packs for 3,000, which is a good deal. You're paying 750 on a pack instead of 1,000. And if you manage to get a couple of more wins, or if you want to run it back a couple of times, you can get more. So that's pretty cool. One of the disadvantages, of course, if you're a new player, is that in the event, your matchmaking rating is not in effect. So what that means, normally you have a hidden MMR that is not tied to the rank you're in. So that's why you sometimes play against players that seem higher ranked. Like sometimes you are in silver and you play against master players, and that's because of the hidden matchmaking ranking you have. So that doesn't apply in the event though. So you might get matched against people who have not only a better collection, but also a way more experience and are just playing better, just because the matchmaking in the event is only based on the amount of wins you have. So you will have trouble winning the full 7 or even 6 when you're a new player. So that's a little bit of a disadvantage. That being said, it's a great way to get packs when you don't really enjoy drafting a lot. There's a lot of advantages in this kind of event for a couple of people. Personally, I just love it when there are new special rules, because at heart I'm a deck builder, and I'm not building a new deck for this, but if there was a special rule, I would definitely try to like make the best out of that. And I enjoy events that have special rules more also. So
I think those are so fun. The last one were multi-faction unit got cost reduced. That was, I think you had a great time in that one. Absolutely. I'm definitely coming around after listening to your points, because especially the one where, you know, draft is a great way to improve your collection, but not everyone wants to draft. And I think this is, like you mentioned, a very solid alternate way to boost your collection if you just want to see yourself as a constructive only player. I think on that note, DWD is giving the player the options. But I was thinking maybe you could give even more rewards before people jump on the, it's like, hey, DWD is already super generous. I'm not talking about more cards or make the cost of entry cheaper, but more cosmetic reward. Make it such that people, perhaps like myself or some other people that are more like on the edge, are more incentivized to play. So for example, let's say if you're in the top 100 leaderboard, you get some sort of badge or a totem that you could use until the next event. Like if you do well in this event, you just get a cool totem that only you have until the next event.
Oh, that would be cool. So let's say you, for the top 500 on leaderboard, they get a special totem or a special avatar.
Sure.
Until the next event or forever or
probably until the next event. So like, yeah, you want to keep them coming back, right? I mean, that's just a one suggestion. DWD probably has smarter people to come up with more suggestions like that. But I think that first creates more visibility and desire for people to play the event. And even if you don't know about the event, maybe you're not around for the event days, and then come Monday, Tuesday, and you see, oh, what is that totem like? It looks pretty badass. And then, you know, you do a little bit of research / digging, and it's like, oh, I could get this from an event. Let me, the next time I come up, I'm going to try to save the goal and make the time to play it for it.
Yeah, I think it's a cool idea. It also creates excitement. Like if you're a new player and you start playing and you see this awesome totem or avatar and you're like, okay, I want to get this. Where do I get this? And people sure. are like, okay, so you can't really get this normally. Well, maybe they will do something like a vintage sale or something with old totems they've given out this way. But hey, there's this monthly event where you can win those and you can participate in this event. And that it just creates, excitement for these events. I think it would be a nice change, actually. It's a good input. You should feedback that, dude. Use the in-game feedback option.
We are feedbacking right now by making this podcast. I'm sure DWD always listens to the very end of our podcast. That definitely will sit around half the time for that. Which, by the way, for the people that are sitting here and still listening to us rant, thank you for your time. I was also thinking it not just for the event, but also more for the latter, finishing top 100 master in draft or constructed. At the same time, though, I feel like it's perhaps better for event because the barrier to entry is much lower, right? In order to get top 100 master and get, let's say, a cool totem from that, you need to spend a ton of hours, whereas events is just like 3 runs, you know?
Yeah, and I think like the top 100, like the leaderboard being released, it already gives you so many bragging rights. I think that's...
Bragging rights. Okay, that's fair.
But that's what it's about, right? I mean, you're not
that's
not
what it's
anything.
About.
Yeah, it is. Like, everybody master gets the same season reward. So if you want to be in the top 100, you only want to do it for your ego. That's it, right?
So as a rank 27 drafter, Rico, yeah. Do you talk down about my draft? Are you master this season yet?
I am not master in anything. I haven't gotten the time to play a lot, and I've played a lot of dubious choices.
Yeah, damn right. So you're not a master player. Your opinions mean nothing to me now.
Fair enough.
It's all about them bragging rights. Oh, man.
Yeah, let's see. Maybe I'll make it to master, but I'm not sure. I think this season I won't be.
You'll get there. We've still got 2 weeks.
Yeah.
We still got 2 weeks. So I don't have anything more to say about the price structure. I still think everything is okay. Like, if there is no changes, I won't, you know, again, make an angry Reddit post or anything like that. But I definitely think that DWD has definitely a lot of ways to, I don't know, beautify the game or put more in the game for the players.
For sure.
One thing that Hearthstone does, and I know people like dislike perhaps bring up Hearthstone comparison, is I really like them like giving carbacks. I think they give it every month and for a lot of like special promos. We could do that here too, right?
Yeah, it's a cool idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff to do.
I would just like to take this a moment and appreciate what Direwolf Digital does. I think they, like, every patch, I think they do something that further improves the game, and also things that I didn't know that could or didn't think I would need improving, but I still appreciate them doing it. For example, how the filters look now in your collection is just so much smoother than it was before. And they didn't have a problem with it before, but it just shows that they are putting a lot of thought into every detail. So I'm sure they thought of something in along those lines. And I'm pretty sure we will get like card backs or play mats. Like, isn't the Halloween playmat kind of announced already?
I believe so.
Yeah. So I think we are getting more cosmetic stuff as they progress working on this game.
Yeah. There you go. So this is going to be the end of the episode, but I do want to give you guys something to look forward to. The next episode, we're going to bring on a very special guest. I won't say who. And we're going to talk about the lore of Eternal. The tale of Horus Traver came out, and they didn't have to put a bomb-ass story in the adventure. But we got a bomb-ass story anyways, and it was super good because we didn't expect it. You know, we just... Because Jack's Bounty, honestly, wasn't, storyline-wise, wasn't that great. And Tale of Horus Traver came out. I was like, though, it was okay. You know, it's like Wild West kind of thing. But this was like, whoa, you know. We got some lore stuff going on.
Yeah, the cool part about this is, like, the Strangers have been around since day one. So, and this is, like, everybody at Direwolf, they knew this, and they knew the background story. They, like, this has to be a great feeling, right? Like, knowing something, and then finally getting to release it. I think that must be fun. And I think there's, like, this makes me think there's more. There's more that they know that we don't, and I'm excited to
Of course they know more.
Yeah, obviously, but like the depth of the story, like, is, I think, was really engaging. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about the lore.
Yeah, and we will learn more about the lore. Our special guest, in fact, will be essentially running the show next week because we know very little about the lore. And we're going to bring a special guru to talk about the lore. Important questions will be answered, such as, where did Sandstorm Titan Scarf go?
Mm.
Why is Horus Traver important? Who are some of the baddies in Eternal? Like, you know, we all know the Scions, but who are the bad guys? And there are some bad guys out there.
So, quick question. How many gems would you spend for a scarf on the root?
You're talking about shift stones or actual gems?
Actual gems.
Ooh, that's like, a hard one. I gotta see the scarf first, you know? Is it animated? Is it gonna be wavy? Is it, you know...
I mean, you have three like titans, so I would assume they would be animated.
Yeah, but, you know, what kind of material are they putting in that scarf? Is it some cheap-ass wool, or is it...
No,
you know...
I think it's 100% cotton.
I wouldn't pay any gem for 100% cotton, dude.
No?
Cotton scarf are not good, right? I don't know. My girlfriend knitted me a scarf, and it was not cotton, so I do not believe in cotton. Anyways, guys, that is the end of this episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And that's it for now. For Rico, I am Luminous, and we will see you next time. Bye, guys.
Bye.